From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley. And our first guest today is biologist and author Karen Lloyd, who shares a firsthand account of the hunt for life beneath Earth's surface. This is in her latest book, Intraterrestrials, Discovering the Strangest Life on Earth.
Then we speak with Dr. Marcia Bjornerud, a structural geologist and professor of environmental studies and geosciences at Lawrence University in Appleton, Wisconsin. Dr. Bjornerud has written several books, including a new one titled Turning to Stone, Discovering the Subtle Wisdom of Rocks.
Now, contrary to their reputation, rocks have a very eventful life. You know, their reputation is that they're kind of just...
I've read about it.
Yeah. Lazy, but they're not. They intersect with our own in surprising ways. From sandstone aquifers purifying the water we drink to the foundations which New York City's tallest skyscrapers sit upon, to basalt formations slowly regulating global climate.
Environmental education and awareness, that's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
We are really excited to first speak with biologist and author Karen Lloyd. Now, Karen has written a new book called Intraterrestrials, Discovering the Strangest Life on Earth. Karen, thank you for joining us here on This Green Earth.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. First, we like to start with your background, and then we'll get that understanding of what an intraterrestrial is.
Cool. So I did my undergraduate degree in biochemistry at Swarthmore College, and I did my PhD and master's in marine sciences at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. And then I did a postdoc in Denmark at Aarhus University, which was kind of cool to give me. I don't know what it was technically in, but I was at the Center for Geomicrobiology, and maybe that's a word people don't know, but that's what I do is geomicrobiology.
I like that.
You have a very fascinating background, and this all brought you to penning this new book, and it's titled Intraterrestrials. Now, this is not a word that you stumble into quite often, so can you tell us how you came up with this title and what it means to you?
Well, it's sort of like the reason I chose the word intraterrestrials for the book is that it encompasses a lot of the, it carries a lot of weight as a word, because what I'm trying to do in this book is sort of introduce people to a biological world that isn't often talked about. And I find in conversations with people don't know that it exists. And so that really was my motivation for writing the book was, you know, literally walking along the street and looking at somebody on the street and thinking, oh, you poor thing, you don't know the cool things that I know about life on this earth. And I want to share that with you. So this intraterrestrials is about life inside Earth's crust, which is not, you know, it's sort of in hot springs like Yellowstone. That's definitely part of it. And maybe that's the part that people have heard about. But there's so much more than that. I mean, there's tiny cracks and little crevices to hide in. And our crust is basically just completely marbleized with living beings.
And by living beings, are we talking about mostly at the bacterial or even smaller level?
Yeah, so bacteria is a word that sort of is a branch, one of the three branches of the tree of life. There's another one called archaea, which kind of, you can kind of lump them together with bacteria in your head, but they are all tiny single-celled organisms that maybe you could put those into a single category in your mind, but actually when you start studying them, they fan out into much more diverse groups. So for instance, everything in the surface world that we touch and think about on a daily basis either breathes oxygen or makes oxygen through photosynthesis. Like that's it. Mm-hmm. It's really just two processes. But all this life in the subsurface, they can breathe pretty much everything on the periodic table. You know, they can take sulfur, pure sulfur, things that look like minerals, and turn it into life.
So when you define these microbes, how do you declare them alive? Like how do you, when you're bringing them in, what's that declaration of life?
Oh, that is often a huge struggle.
Right.
We often have to leave open the possibility that what we're studying is dead on an individual cell basis. But across the entire community, we have a bunch of different ways of knowing that they're alive down there. One is that we can see the slow accumulation of waste products from them, and we can see that they use up food slowly over time. We can see that they have the presence of small biomolecules inside their cells that would have degraded if, you know, these deposits that we find are sometimes tens of thousands of years old or even older, and no RNA, no small fragile biomolecule is going to remain intact for that long. So the fact that they're intact, they're maintaining their bodies, they're producing waste, they're breathing, they're eating, we can see all these things happening.
How do they fit into the larger ecosystem around them? Are they a source of food? Are they helping, like you said, maybe allude to, helping to break down waste products or something like that? What is their role in the ecosystem?
They have a bunch of different roles because, you know, we're talking about a layer of earth that's covering the entire earth, that's underneath the layer that we interact with. Mm-hmm. So in the same way that you couldn't say what the single thing does that life does at the surface of the earth, well, life does a lot of things. You know, oxygen, we break down carbon, our fungi recycle it. Deeper down, they're doing all the same sorts of things, but doing them just a little bit differently. So they don't have the sun, but they have things that are like plants. They're called chemolithoautotrophs. And so they are producing biomass, they're dying, they're feeding other things. From our perspective, they do a couple of things on an immediate level that really help us out. And one is that they recycle a lot of nutrients. Mm. So a lot of the things that they work with, like nitrogen and phosphorus and iron, are things that we are completely dependent on. Our oceans are dependent on these elements that have sort of been released by the subsurface and come back up and can seed our phytoplankton populations that can like make sure that we continue to have oxygen up at the surface. So they're sort of providing that ecosystem service for everybody up at the surface.
The book describes you venturing into extreme locales to research these biological phenomena and non-oxygen environments, so volcanoes or undersea vents. Where did you go and what did you experience?
Yeah, I'll go pretty much anywhere as long as it's pretty safe. Yeah. Believe it or not, I'm not an adrenaline junkie, but I do like to go to meet these. I really like that word you just used, biological phenomena.
Yeah.
They're so different and weird. It's like, right. What do you call them? I have been in multiple submersibles to a mile deep and half a mile deep in the ocean in both the Pacific and the Atlantic. Well, I guess the Gulf of Mexico. And it's just a privilege to get to do that. It's not something that we have the resources to have a lot of people do. So whenever I get the chance to go to the bottom of the ocean, I take it pretty seriously and try to use my time wisely. And there's volcanoes are also attractive because anything that sort of automatically brings what is deeply buried inside Earth's crust up to the surface is going to be a point of interest for my work. So while there aren't living microbes in lava, that's too hot, it would break down cells. All of the volcanic activity brings up these nutrients that are from the deep earth that can sustain these populations. So then we look at the areas around volcanoes and sometimes in the craters of volcanoes to see who's sort of buried down, nestled down in the deeper reaches that's using all these chemicals.
And when you're studying this, how do you determine the age of these? How do you know how old they are? Because I'm imagining they can be thousands, maybe even a million years old.
Yeah, so that is something that we are actively working on. As far as the age goes, the thing that we can really put a date on is the layer of geological formation that they're sitting in. Mm. That's the thing that we can date. And we can also often know what the history of that has been. So I study some ancient permafrost in Siberia, and we can look at the crystalline structure of this frozen soil and see that it has never been unfrozen for a million years. And so in those cases, we can say, okay, the organisms that we find here have been either they or their lineage have been sitting here for a million years. Then what do they look like? What you know, are they alive? Do we find evidence that they are living? Are they intact? And if so, have they changed at all? And as far as we can tell, there's not a lot of change that happens over these million years that things are buried. You know, it's just, we can, it's not just permafrost, it's also deeply buried underneath the oceanic sediments. And there's not, if we look at the total energy that's available to these things and the rate at which it's delivered, it's not enough energy to really sustain a lot of cell divisions. So our assumption has to be that they are as old, that individual cells may be as old as the layer of sediments that they sit in, which could maybe not be true, but to a first approximation, that appears to be true.
Wow. When were these microbes first, I don't know, say, discovered or so? I mean, was Humboldt aware of them? Was Darwin aware of them? Were the scientists back in the, you know, 19th or 18th century aware of microbes?
I would guess not. I mean, microbes, sort of Edward Koch is credited with the first pure culture of microbes in 1885. I think he cultured Bacillus anthracis, which is the normal soil microbe that produces anthrax. Before that, there was Antonie von Leeuwenhoek, who developed the first microscope in like the mid-1600s, I want to say. And so he's credited with being the first person to actually like see these things. I think he called them animalcules. I don't know how to pronounce that word. So for centuries, scientists have known about the existence of microbes. You know, this is something that's really flourished. We know that there's a huge diversity of microbial life on Earth. They do a huge diversity of things. They grow on petri dishes. They grow in your laboratory. Sometimes you wait overnight and they're fully grown, teeming mass of cells, and you can do all kinds of experiments on them. And this gave us enough to chew on for hundreds of years that we never... You know, we never would have known that anything else was out there. You know, there's plenty. There isn't that enough? All the great diversity of bacteria that exist. But then we got a new toy, and the new toy is DNA sequencing directly from the environment. Mm. So not sequencing an organism, not like taking a blood sample from something and seeing what its genome looks like after we already see the thing, but rather just like pulling up some muck from the bottom of the ocean or filtering some seawater or, you know, just grabbing some dirt. And that, we can extract the DNA from that. And that's when, I would say in the late 80s, kind of in the late 90s is when this really started becoming democratized and lots of us were doing this. We were like, oh man, we were missing a lot. There's so much more in there.
And so much more, I'm supposing.
Yeah, the thing is that we already had a huge diversity of life that we knew about from growing all these cultures. You know, we, with the larger weave, like the field of microbiology, I certainly don't take credit for that.
Right.
But when those of us who started looking at DNA sequences directly from the environment started doing that, all of the DNA sequences I was pulling out of these hydrothermal vents or methane seeps, I shouldn't say all, the vast majority of them looked nothing like anything anybody had ever grown before. So even with the great diversity of microbial life that we had known about, we were finding even weirder stuff. Phylogenetically speaking. So they were deeper branches on the tree of life, whole new phyla. Like a phylum is a very high level of the taxonomic groupings. It's like all of invertebrates are a phylum, I think. I'm not so good at my animal taxonomy, but it's really a very high level thing. And we were pulling out new phyla like daily.
It's really interesting to me to try to wrap my head around these microbes and these spaces in the earth that we would consider to maybe be very inhospitable for anything that's living. Have you studied them long enough? Are they reacting to climate change? Can you see any changes or differences?
Does that matter to them? Yeah.
And does it, yeah, matter?
Yeah, that's a great question. Certainly it will matter in some areas. So one thing that is definitely going to matter for them is when we actively put things down into the earth, which is not necessarily a bad thing. So there's a lot of climate change mitigation strategies that involve sticking liquidized CO2 back down into spent oil wells or deep saline aquifers to try to lock it up and keep it as a way to sequester that. And so that is absolutely going to affect these populations. And then the big question is, well, how are they going to react to this over the short term? And then over the long term, are they going to help us? Or are they going to just spit it right back out at us and, you know, basically gum up the works and precipitate everything out and make us unable to put any more down there? All that is really a very nascent area of research, and we need to figure a lot more out about it. But certainly, just in terms of like the things that are the natural things that are changing with climate change, it's going to change basically their interface with our surface world. Increased rainfall is going to change the delivery of materials down to the deeper subsurface. Changes in organic matter delivery to surficial sediments in the sea are going to change their ability to work with things like methane. So I think that the deep down ones will be affected when we actively inject things into their world, and the ones at the interface are going to be affected by, you know, all the other things that we are affected by for climate change.
We're speaking with Karen Lloyd. She's a biologist and author of the new book, Intraterrestrials, Discovering the Strangest Life on Earth. So Karen, is it possible that these intraterrestrials might be found in extraterrestrial settings, i.e., you know, Mars, Venus, et cetera? Is there curiosity about that?
Man, I hope they're there. Wouldn't it be great? There's absolutely, I would love it. You know, when I look at the surface, you know, the images that people are taking of Mars or Europa, that's just, you know, we don't see life flourishing at the surface.
Right.
But it could certainly be there because I, you know, in my job, I look at landscapes that are just as desolate looking as Mars or Europa. And I know that they have lots and lots of different, diverse microbial life there. So when I look at Mars and Europa, I don't see certain desolation, especially when you dig back the layers and you're more protected from UV radiation. I think that there's a lot of good places for microbial life to hide. So my assumption would be that a lot of planetary bodies have microbial life. We just need to disprove it.
I don't know if that's a good thing or not, Karen, because if that's discovered, or if there's, you know, better thoughts that there is microbial life like that on Europa or Mars, that means our multi-billionaires will spend even more billions of dollars to go to those places rather than spending their billions of dollars to finish exploring this planet. So that's where I come from there. Because there's so
much more
to explore. Your work is evidence of that.
That's right.
What's the next exploration you're interested in? Where do you want to go next? What's left to be explored about these microbes?
I mean, I think that probably the thing you should take from my book or my work is that it may, when it seems like everything's already known and the textbooks have pretty much got everything sewn up tight, that's not true. There's so much more to be learned. So my next work is back to the Arctic. We're going to look for some more in permafrost. We're going to look for some more delicate biomolecules to see further evidence of who's actually alive in the places that we've been looking. But I'm always game for anywhere. And there's so much that we haven't explored all over Earth and inside Earth.
Right.
How would you describe the way in which you present the information in this book? For example, for the layperson like myself, if I pick it up, can I grasp it? Am I reading the sentence over and over and looking up the words, 60% of the words? Or
I hope not. I'll tell you, the way I wrote this book is that I wrote it in my most communicative, non-jargony, not for a scientific audience, for a general audience. I would write a whole section as forwardly as I could, and then I would set it aside, and then I would go back and completely rewrite it and take jargon out. So I had to like remove layer upon layer of science speak. And I think what I ended up with is something that's really fun, I basically just thought, like, what is the craziest analogy I can think of for the concept that I'm trying to convey? I don't know. I talk about, like, Missy Elliott's Flip It and Reverse It song, which I think is just a fantastic song. And it's a great analogy for DNA sequencing.
I love it. And I asked that question because I do know that you were very intentional about making sure that myself and others that don't work in this can pick this up and understand it and have a grasp of it. And I think it's interesting for us to have this greater understanding of what we're standing on and what's beneath the surface.
Yeah, well, real quick, we got a minute or so. I got a text from a listener who wanted to know about deserts and microbial life in desert settings. Did you visit desert-like settings?
Yeah, so deserts are amazing because you can often turn over a rock or flick a couple of layers off the outside of a rock, mm-hmm. and there will be a green line inside the rock. So the name of the game there is surviving the onslaught of sunlight. And so one way to do it is to hide inside rocks, which I just think is fascinating.
And surviving in the absence of water.
Right. So the water's there. It's just not in high abundance.
Okay.
And so I sort of maybe counterintuitively, the problems that people face in deserts who study microbial life in deserts or any life in deserts are similar to what we do in permafrost, because there's plenty of water in permafrost, but it's all crystalline in the form of ice.
So is water then still a common requirement for all of these microbes?
Yep.
Oh.
We have never found something that cannot get by without water. And we have not found something that does not have DNA just yet.
Okay.
These are things that seem to be common for absolutely every inch of life on Earth so
they're
far.
Breathing from the periodic table, but they have to have water. Oh, that's so fascinating.
That's right.
No.
That's right.
Oh, wow. Well, this is such such fantastic work that you're doing. We're glad that you put out this book so that we can all better understand what is happening beneath the surface. So thank you so much for being a part of This Green Earth. It's Karen Lloyd, who has just penned the book, Intraterrestrials, Discovering the Strangest Life on Earth. And where can people find you or your work? Do you have a website?
My website is, it's kind of in flux right now, but it's at the University of Southern California. You can find it. But the book is wherever you buy books.
Right.
It's in Amazon, whatever.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Karen.
Thanks, Karen.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us for the second part of the show is Dr. Marcia Bjornerud. Dr. Bjornerud is a structural geologist and professor of environmental studies and geosciences at Lawrence University in Appleton, Wisconsin. Dr. Bjornerud has written several books, including the most recent one titled Turning to Stone, Discovering the Subtle Wisdom of Rocks. Dr. Bjornerud, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me to the program.
Oh, perfect. We always like to start with a little background on our guests. So give us a little background about yourself. Specifically, why geology? What turned you to want to pursue a career in geology?
Well, like many geologists, I sort of happened upon the field by accident as a first-year college student seeking to fulfill a science requirement. I didn't really think of myself as a science type. I grew up in the 70s, and there weren't too many female role models in my high school who were teaching science, and so I was really a humanities-oriented student, but I took an introductory geology course my very first term, first year, and fell in love with it because I think its great explanatory power attracted me. I'd always been interested in the etymology of words, how words came down to us, and I realized that geology was really the etymology of the world.
Mm-hmm.
It explained how things came to be the way they are.
So for our younger listeners who might also be curious about geology, what does the geologist do, or what is the different kinds of career paths a geologist can take?
Well, traditionally, and I think in many people's minds, geology is hopelessly entangled with extractive industries. And to some degree, that's still the case. Geologists are responsible for helping locate essential resources, minerals, oil, gas, groundwater. But more and more geologists, and certainly students that I've had over the past three decades, are finding themselves in all kinds of careers, focusing on environmental protection, working for state and federal agencies, or in the public policy sector, trying to make laws and practices that are more aligned with the way the Earth works. So there's really a wide array of potential pathways that people can take if they go into the geosciences these days.
Right. I worked as an environmental engineer for several firms over the decades, and there were always geologists on staff. And they were, like you alluded to, involved in the environmental end of geology, studying soils, rocks, formations, mostly related with the relationship with groundwater movement, et cetera. So you can, like you say, one of the career paths is in the environmental field.
Right. And I think more than anything, I've realized, again, in my decades of teaching, that geology is above all a kind of worldview. It's a set of cognitive habits, the capacity to zoom in and out of time scales and spatial scales. And it's a very sophisticated sort of way of thinking. And I think those kind of cognitive skills are less appreciated by some people, but geologists have the ability to envision multiple versions of the world, to see into the subsurface and into the past.
Yeah, which brings us to an introduction into your book, really. And I saw that you had said something about geology could be very intellectual, but also it has become more philosophical and even spiritual. And that kind of bends into this latest book that you've penned, Turning to Stone, Discovering the Subtle Wisdom of Rocks. Can you talk us through maybe that, I don't know if that was an evolution inside of you or just seeing this change from this very intellectual look at geology into the philosophy of our past and rocks and our relationship as humans to rocks?
Yeah, so I think my initial attraction to the field was mainly intellectual, academic, but in practicing geology, and as you said at the outset, I'm a structural geologist, so I study mountain building and tectonics, and I've been lucky enough to spend long summers in the field in fairly remote places, especially in the high Arctic regions of Norway and Canada. The practice of geology has become grafted completely to my experience of being a human on Earth as well. So it is my personal as well as scientific way of seeing the world. And that's what I'm trying to share in my book, that geology has these practical applications, but it also addresses these deep philosophical existential questions about origins and what our role is in the long term as earthlings.
Yeah, we talk about the impermanence maybe of landscapes and how the earth has been ever changing over these millions of years. And it was generally this very, very slow and natural shift. And now it feels as if these changes are happening more rapidly, maybe because of human impact and what we are doing to the planet.
It's true, but I think that we have been under the illusion that the Earth always moves at a slow pace. The Earth has many tempos. You know, plate tectonics is usually a stately 1 or 2 inches per year kind of process, but occasionally plates lurch in earthquakes, that when the Earth moves faster than we'd like it to. And there certainly have been times in the past of great upheavals in the climate or hydrologic systems. Of course, humans weren't generally around for some of those things. So I think part of what I'm trying to convey to people is that, yes, thank goodness, most of the time, Earth is incrementally remaking itself in a way that we barely notice. But it also can change quickly. And we are accelerating some of those processes that normally unfold at a slower pace.
Well, it's interesting because if you live in California along the West Coast or other parts of the world, i.e. Pakistan or so, boy, the Earth is moving all the time. So forget about this, mountain building and plate tectonics on a slow, stately case. They're experiencing the plate tectonics and movements almost on a daily basis.
Absolutely, and we treat those as catastrophes when, in fact, that is just the way a dynamic planet functions. And so another message in my book is that let's understand the way the planet works and make sure that we're living in a sensible way with these inevitable upheavals.
And we can break down some of the areas of our Earth that you took a deep dive into, but I do want to talk about here on this green Earth, we do chat about putting these human characteristics sometimes onto wildlife. And in your book, I'd like you to describe this thought process of having rocks be capable of a kind of language or expression.
Yeah, and so of course, as a scientist, I'm venturing into somewhat dangerous territory. Mm-hmm. Animism is a definite taboo in the sciences, or anthropomorphism. And yet, I think that if you really asked most geoscientists, they would acknowledge that they feel in some way that the Earth and rocks are communicative, are in some way animate. As a structural geologist, I think of rocks folding, flowing, moving. Mm. You know, in that sense, they're literally animate. They're in motion. And, you know, amazingly enough, we can understand their language. It's always been a dream of humans to be able to communicate with animals. And so far, we've had limited success even applying AI to the challenge. Mm-hmm. But we can, in a way, communicate with rocks. We know what they're saying. So I'm pushing the boundaries, but I hold myself to a very rigorous scientific standard in explaining the logic of geology and how we've been able to sort of decipher the language of rocks.
It's very fascinating.
I gotta pursue that a little more. When you say language, can you parse that out a little more?
Yeah, and I mean, it's a metaphor. It's not a literal thing, but it's true that when we look, and different rocks speak different languages or dialects, if you like. You know, we can understand a sandstone. That's the first chapter of my book. Each chapter uses a particular rock type as kind of a lens for exploration. We know the language of sandstones through direct observation. We can see places on Earth today where those are forming, so we can translate what we know about the modern environment back into the past. But each rock type has its own idioms in the form of the minerals and the textures in the rocks that are in some way like texts that need deciphering. So I find the literary or the language metaphors helpful. They're, you know, ultimately they fail, I suppose, but they're close.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, I often do feel that I'm reading rocks.
Okay, so sticking with sandstone, what is some of the biological or chemical or environmental benefits that sandstone provides humans or ecosystems?
Well, many parts of the world have sandstones as as groundwater aquifers. The grains of a typical sand are round and they don't fit, you know, tightly together. There's always pore space in between, like marbles in a jar. And so groundwater has plenty of space to move through. So that's a major ecosystem service, I suppose, that sandstone can provide. Sandstones have been used for building materials. Many of them are, you know, wonderfully carvable. So they're, you know, think of the beautiful city of Petra in Jordan, or the oolitic sandstones in the city of Bath in the UK, or Oxford. You know, they're aesthetic things as well. They form beautiful landscapes out there in Utah. You've got lots of beautiful sandstones in Arches and Zion.
Right.
So they're the infrastructure of so many places.
How about then turning to, I guess it's granitic rock or so, without which, you know, we would have no parts of the skyscrapers of New York City or other large metropolitan areas where, you know, those rocks form as the fundamental foundation for many of those.
Right, buildings. We wouldn't have any continents.
Yeah.
So, yeah, granite is really an amazing invention of Earth. We don't think that any of the rocky planets, the other rocky planets in our solar system, have invented granite. It's not something that can be produced in a single melting episode from the mantle of the planets. And that's one of the main messages of my book as well, is that Earth is incredibly creative. It started with the same raw materials as Mercury, Venus, and Mars, but it has created an amazing array of minerals and rocks from those same raw materials that none of those other planets have. So the geology of the Moon or Mars or Venus, pretty simple. There are only a few, maybe half dozen rock types at most, and probably, you know, maybe a quarter of the number of minerals. Earth, because of the presence of water and the process of plate tectonics and, of course, life too, has had ways of recombining all those primordial ingredients in new ways.
So in some ways, no granite, no us?
I think not, because we would have been an ocean planet, probably.
Yeah.
Granite concentrates things that are critical to life forms, especially phosphorus and potassium. The evolution of life on Earth, maybe there would have been life, but it would be utterly different without continents. and therefore, granite is critical to the way things have played out here.
Interesting.
Evolutionarily.
Yeah, we're speaking with Dr. Marcia Bjornerud, a structural geologist and professor of environmental studies and geosciences at Lawrence University in Appleton, Wisconsin. Dr. Bjornerud has written a number of books, including a most recent one titled Turning to Stone, Discovering the Subtle Wisdom of Rocks.
As we talk about granite, you cover, like you said, in different chapters of this book, different areas of our planet and stone, and describe it, some from millions of years back, some from thousands of years back. And you do a lot of concentration also in your home state of Wisconsin, which I think is really interesting. But then you also travel to Norway. As you were working your way through this book, can you describe how you did this research and brought this all together into these chapters and breaking it down so that someone like me could understand it?
As you said, I've written a couple of other books, and with this one, I hope to take people deeper into a more nuanced understanding, especially of how the solid Earth works. So, you know, I don't focus much on dinosaurs or some of the more familiar parts of Earth's history. I really wanted to help people understand how amazing the Earth itself and the tectonic processes that interact with biological and hydrological ones work. So I had a few false starts. It didn't initially set out to have my own story as the framework, but I found that each time it seemed too textbooky. So finally, an editor I'd worked with said, you know, maybe try a memoir of some kind. And I initially just rejected that out of hand. I'm a pretty private person, actually, and I just didn't feel comfortable with that. But then I realized that I could use my own story, as I told you, you know, as kind of an accidental scientist coming in, not thinking of myself as somebody who could do science. And so the book is structured around rocks that I was either living on or obsessed with in my work over the last 40 years or so, starting with my childhood in Wisconsin and the sandstones that I grew up on, and then taking the reader with each chapter into sort of more complex rock stories, you know, including some that people probably have never heard of, some sort of arcane metamorphic rocks that do have amazing insights to share with us about the way the deep subsurface is, and then coming kind of back to the surface at the end with rocks back here in Wisconsin again. So in a broad sense, the narrative arc is sort of like the Greek myth pattern of the protagonist goes down into the underworld mm-hmm. and then comes back up, perhaps having become a bit wiser.
What are some of the questions then that geologists are still wrestling with? What is interesting you per se to learn more about geology and in our planet?
Well, I think more and more geology is about the future. People have this idea that geology is just a retrospective science, right. And certainly it is that. I mean, it's a trying to understand the long, complicated story of the Earth. But that's the best guide we have to what may lie ahead. So, you know, certainly the idea of the Anthropocene, although a committee of geologists voted not to officially adopt that last year as an addition to the timescale, but that concept of the Anthropocene and the extent to which humans have become geologic agents of the first order is very much on the minds of all geologists. So that's certainly, you know, what do the next few decades or centuries have in store for us in light of our knowledge of earlier times of planetary upheaval? But then there are other major fundamental questions that are perhaps just more academic. We don't really have a good grasp on when the habit of plate tectonics on Earth began. Huh. Certainly it didn't start right at the beginning. We can look at Venus and Mars. They never developed the same habits of crustal recycling that are so characteristic of the Earth. So when did Earth adopt that? That has really become the thing over the long term that has kept Earth habitable over billions of years, this habit of plate tectonics and the way that the tectonic system interacts again with the hydrologic and atmospheric systems. That's a pretty big question.
Yeah. Speaking of tectonics, so that's been going on for, well, you know, as long as the planet has been around, I suppose. Is there any sign that it is like slowing, or does it slow in some areas and speed up in others? What does that recycling look like?
Yeah, so the signature process of tectonics on Earth is subduction, which is the process of recycling oceanic crust back into the mantle that happens in places like Indonesia and Japan. It's associated with the largest and most devastating earthquakes, mm-hmm. many of which generate terrible tsunamis. Mm-hmm. But that process of taking ocean crust back into the mantle, again, is critical to long-term stability on Earth because it also takes water back into the mantle and actually keeps the mantle of the Earth, even at Earth's age of 4.5 billion years, able to flow in the solid state and keep on churning and keep on moving the plates around. That process may, as the Earth continues slowly to cool, grind to a halt in a few billion years. Mm. But so far, you know, we've been in this sweet spot for at least 3 billion years where plate tectonics has been operating probably as we know it today. I'm not lying awake worrying right. about plate tectonics ending. I am worrying about human effects on the climate in the much shorter term.
Well, okay.
Yeah, and relating our history and what rocks do for the climate in your study of this and your research of this, looking back, I guess, let's start with how you probably had to go to some challenging areas, I would think, and there were probably some far-reaching places. Tell us a little bit about that and maybe some of the things that you learned from digging deeper into the past as it relates to what we're going through now and into the future.
Yeah, so again, I've been lucky to work in some really remote places where the human imprint on the landscape is just so minimal. You can't have the illusion that humans are in control. So I did my PhD work up in Svalbard, which is an archipelago north of Norway. Mm-hmm. And then I did some postdoctoral work up in Ellesmere Island in high Arctic Canada, which is pretty much as far north as you can go and still be on land. And in both of those places, again, just nature is in charge. And I think that made a deep impression on my psyche, just keeping the human in proper perspective, right. Understanding you really need to respect the power of nature. But the other thing, I don't study glaciers, but in my work in these places, I have seen how quickly climate change is affecting these very high Arctic areas. It's just been shocking to return to some of the places that I knew so well as a graduate student and postdoc and see the landscape utterly changed. I mean, not even being able to recognize where I am because of the amount of retreat of ice. So I've been sort of, I've seen firsthand the reality of climate change just in my own short career.
Well, with just a couple minutes, how we know how climate change has impacts on, you know, on a biological scale and even on a chemical scale or so. I think of oceans and the pH, changes in pH in our oceans, et cetera. But is climate change having an impact on a geological scale?
Well, there's just so many ripples. You mean on the solid Earth itself?
Yeah, on the solid, not a geological, but on, yeah, on the planet's physical forms.
Actually, it can.
Yeah.
There are a couple of cases in Iceland where, of course, it's a very volcanically active area, but where the thinning and melting of glaciers has reduced the pressure on volcanic vents to the point where, you know, the actual immediate cause of some of the eruptions has been melting ice. And in the past, we can look to some cases like that as well. Probably some episodes in the Mediterranean region of volcanism were related to the Mediterranean actually drying up about 5 million years ago. And the, again, the pressure of water being released caused volcanism to happen. It's kind of like taking the cork off a champagne bottle. If the pressure is released, then, you know, magmas that are there don't have much resistance and they'll just come shooting out. So oddly, even the solid Earth can respond to changing phenomena in the hydrosphere and the cryosphere, the icy realm.
Right. Climate skeptics might say, oh, well, you see, that's just the planet responding to this. The more volcanic activity, Dr. Bjornerud, more sulfur and particulate matter emitted to the atmosphere, which serves to kind of dampen or increase the albedo effect. See, when it'll cool off, that's how the planet responds.
Well,
sorry,
wow.
I just had to throw that in there. Yeah,
I think the real message that geoscientists have been absorbing in the last 20 years as we've understood climate better is how incredibly complex it is and how many feedbacks and unpredictable amplifying processes there can be. And any idea that there's a simple causality is really naive. We're dealing with a really complex system of systems, and we need to have some humility.
Thank you.
When people are reading your book, how would you like them to understand better our relationship to rocks, or what you want to evoke in them maybe to be a little bit more interested, or are you trying to ignite something in people to have a little bit more of a, when we look out into the world, understanding of what's happening beneath our feet?
I do. And I really want people to have a sense of themselves as earthlings, as I always say, which is a term we should never have ceded to science fiction. That's right. Our most fundamental identity. And I think for myself, a deep understanding of our place on this remarkable, creative, resilient planet is a source of great existential comfort. And that's what I'm trying to share with people. I think one of the central pathologies of our time is narcissism, both individual and collective human narcissism. We're obsessed with the idea of artificial intelligence and forget there's so much natural intelligence all around us. And if we just open ourselves to that and learn to read the natural landscape, we'll be happier.
Wonderfully stated. I love that.
Yes. Well, we gotta wrap up. The name of the book is Turning to Stone: Discovering the Subtle Wisdom of Rocks. Dr. Marcia Bjornerud is the author. Dr. Bjornerud, website that people can go to learn more about this book, your other writings, your other books.
I'm not really on social media, but you can find me at the Lawrence University website.
Lawrence University, out of Appleton, Wisconsin. Yeah. Beautiful town. Thank you so much, Dr. Bjornerud, for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Oh, thank you. It was a delight. Thanks.
Thank you. Have a great day.